make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here. We are now moving into or dealing with verse 12. Your mother, which again really forms the conclusion to all the things introduced in verse 11. But I try to keep these, if I put them together, it would have been like 75 points. And I feel like sometimes that gets, you lose sight of what's going on if you get into a real long one, I think, sometimes. So, but we're dealing here now with this statement about your mother will be greatly ashamed. And acknowledging that this might be a poetic way, again, of describing the complete destruction of Babylon. She who gave you birth will be humiliated. Again, you have these parallel, synonymous parallel phrases. And it appears that they're talking about a third party. To me, the most natural reading here is that this is a third party. So on the other hand, and we've gotten down to this, point seven now. Well, on the other hand, a careful consideration of the Hebrew tenses used in this section would seem to be indicate that the emotions attributed to Babylon's mother were already a reality prior to her destruction. Verse 11 uses a series of imperfects, which describe the attitudes and actions in which Babylon engages that form the cause or the basis for her destruction. Verse 12, however, uses two Hebrew perfects, which are normally used to denote completed action. Again, in the Hebrew, we really don't have tense, we have aspect. And in terms of action, it's either viewed as complete or incomplete. The perfect is completed action, and the imperfect is incomplete. So this means that while Babylon is still present and engaging in her bad behavior, her mother had already become mortified by the actions of her spoiled child. And that would seem to be very much consistent with what we see in the metaphors used there at the end. Because you skip about like a threshing heifer, the end of verse 11. And you neigh or whinny like stallions. That this is careless, arrogant behavior. And that is the type of thing that would make a mother ashamed of a child. That sort of behavior. So it would appear again that the mother, it says here, they've translated this as a future, but it's really not, or it's not an imperfect at any rate. It's your mother is greatly ashamed. She's already ashamed. I think again, a study of contemporary values and contemporary ideas and attitudes toward America will demonstrate that most nations are not impressed with us any longer. Certainly not the way they used to be. So in that case, one should understand the mother of Babylon to be her progenitor, the female parent from which the nation itself came. And in support of that view, Ezekiel uses a similar figure to describe the origin of Jerusalem, which indicated that the physical heritage of that city was found among the racial Canaanites, Amorites, and Hittites. Ezekiel 16:3. Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem. Your origin and your birth are from the land of the Canaanite. Your father was an Amorite and your mother was a Hittite. And they're used to denote the racial origin, the racial stock from which Jerusalem was originally founded. Maybe not originally, but certainly the ones that came to dominate that city. Your origin and your birth. 12, the term motherland or mother country refers to the place of one's birth, the place of one's ancestors, the place of an ethnic group or immigrant. It stands in contrast to its colonies, which would be viewed, rightly so, as its children. It should be observed that what is referenced here about a mother country and our colonies is not something unique to Great Britain and to the United States. Certainly, we can point historically to the nation from whence our nation came. the genetic stock from which our nation was founded. Just as in Babylonia, it was the Chaldeans. They were the primary racial stock. Now again, that term came to be used not only, I don't think, of racial Chaldeans, but Chaldeans is viewed as a race of people that were very good with astrology, and it came to convey more than just race, I think. Because it's included in this list of things, say, in Daniel, the magicians, the conjurers, the Chaldeans. So they were known for this stuff. Several nations in history have had the status of a mother country as they expanded their empires to create new colonies, i.e. bore children in other parts of the world. Nations and in countries that have colonized significant parts of the world during the days of their empire include the Danish, the Dutch, the Belgian, the French, the German, the Italian, the Portuguese, the Spanish, and most notably, the British. Now, we certainly know that of those empires, the most far-flung was probably the British Empire, in terms of just sheer amount of the globe it moved into. But some of these other empires were pretty great during their time as well. They had some pretty far-flung colonies. So not all these countries had the same degrees of success during their ascendancy. It was not unusual for colonies to refer to their mother country. Even though they may not have all been equally successful, this term is kind of frequent. I mean, you can find usages of it without any problem. Well, 13, given that the other prophetic passages that deal with prophetic Babylon, one would have to find a colony that had been so successful that she exercised her dominion over the kings and the businessmen of the earth. I didn't put the actual verses there, but we know from Revelation 18 that this nation was quite successful and quite influential. Verse 3 actually is where it is introduced. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. The kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And this is political and international immorality. Again, this is not sexual immorality. Now, this is global internationalism, the opposite of what God established for nations, the principle, the divine institution of nationalism. So we have promoted this idea of a global community and involved ourselves in many, many nations. And often without provocation and often without them desiring us to even be there at all. We have had our way with them, more or less. The merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Again, her love of luxury. This is what makes them rich. Because, again, people have to have the highest and the best. That's all that we'll do. And that mentality, of course, keeps the wheels of consumerism and capitalism turning. As we must do, because my goodness, if we let this thing, what happened? Well, we can't have that. So we have to keep buying. That's the key element. So again, this nation has to be one. This colony would have to be one that was so successful that it would probably, I would think, have to be the premier colony almost that's ever existed of nations that have colonized places. Well, thus, one must seek a colony of some noted empire that rose to a position of such prominence that her destruction would send a political and economic world into paroxysms. That's fits or convulsions. Paroxysms of despair. Because when this goes down, of course, all their attitude is, woe is me, woe is me. And, of course, some of the feeling must have to be out there among these nations and politicians and businessmen that if this can happen to the greatest, quote, nation on the planet, this has to strike great fear into them. Now, what they won't know is that Russia will have expended its entire nuclear arsenal on this. So their fears will be somewhat unfounded. But let's face it, if Russia desires after the destruction of the U.S., to become the ruler of the world, essentially. They've got plenty of conventional military stuff to attack all those around them. Those states, those Baltic states and those little satellites of Russia, they know they're not safe. They know they live in the shadow of the bear. And that's not a good place to live. You don't want to live just right outside the bear's den. You probably want to be a little further away if you can. So Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, again, is analogous to the U.S., the only nation that suits all the qualifications, which was established as the offspring of the Anglo-Saxon peoples from Great Britain, her mother, the one who bore her. And in 2016, the Pew Research Center conducted a survey of then-current attitudes of the British toward the United States, which were, to be certain, generally positive. This included Britain's views on the American approach to civil liberties, U.S. global leadership, the military response to ISIS, and the American work ethic. Well, they haven't been here much, or they might not be quite as impressed with that. But that's obviously they're judging from a distance, and that's fine. Those perceptions won't be the same as if you were right up close to it. Well, however, it is evident from the research, that should be from, not form, from that research that the citizens of the UK do not appreciate the lack of American tolerance, and a majority consider the nation to be characterized by the negative traits of arrogance, greed, and violence. Huh. Well, that pretty well sums us up, doesn't it? I mean, and again, you got to love the next generation. Fortunately, it'll be the last one. We don't have to put up with children anymore after a point. As they walk out of school to change the world. Now, did that change anything? No, not really. Will it change anything? No, not really. So, had I been a principal at one of these schools, I would have just notified him. You walk out of the school today, you're suspended for a week, and all your grades will be zeros. You're not free to do this. And put an end to this nonsense. This isn't changing anything. We tried this back when we were hippies in the 60s. We marched, we protested, we dodged the draft, burned our draft cards and our bras. And I didn't, but other people did. And did it change the world? Did women get equal rights? No, they're still making 70% of what a man makes, generally speaking. Now, I'm not saying some of these inequities have not been addressed. They have. But does this change anything? Protesting. The Occupy Wall Street people, did that change anything? No. And why are people doing this? This is the stupidity of the American public. They really think they have input into this illusion we call the two-party system. And it is simply an illusion of choice. It does not give you a choice. They all work for the same people, and it's not us. And any study of politics in America in the last 50 years, that should be increasingly evident if people look at the homework. Well, guess what? They like certain things about us, but there's a whole lot they didn't like about us. And it's getting worse. While it would seem that the mother of the U.S. is already somewhat mortified by the behavior of this nation's, those emotions will no doubt be intensified when the nation is utterly destroyed. You're ashamed of your child that acts badly, but you don't want him dead. Well, hopefully not. I mean, but any parent, every normal parent's wanted to kill their kid probably at one time or the other. You know, we just don't act on those thoughts. We recognize, well, you know, no, deal with them, discipline them and all that. You can't kill them. But obviously that's going to be that those feelings, they're going to have to ask the hard questions. Why did this happen? And it appears, again, what we're going to look at here just quickly, we're only going to go over the first few verses in Daniel 7 that are germane to the United States. But the reality is here, when we look at that, Britain has a future. We don't. Britain is going to survive all this. It is one of those animals. In fact, Russia will survive all this. And so will the Far Eastern nations. And to some extent, not totally, the beast won't survive it all. So what happens to the European Union after the destruction of the beast and his forces? We don't know, but it doesn't appear that they go on. The beast is destroyed and his body is given to the burning fire, as it says in Daniel. These other countries, these other nations that are portrayed by animals, why does God use animals to portray nations? Because this symbolizes man in his lower nature. His predatory, and all the animals, as we're going to see in Daniel there, all the animals are apex predators. All of them. Eagles, lions, bears, and leopards or tigers, depending on which one you want there. And I watched the other day, I was looking at that and I got to thinking about it. And I watched on YouTube a lion and a tiger fighting. It was vicious. It was ferocious. And I think the lion finally won. But the lion, which symbolizes Great Britain, as we'll see, they're going to have a future after this. They're going to orient. And so they're going to recognize this happened. God took this nation out. And historically, we were fortunate to be separated from them, as it will turn out. So again, are they already mortified? Yes. But is that going to become worse? Yeah, probably. As time goes on. It's not as though, out of Britain you hear everybody's really impressed with Trump and they like what he's doing. You don't hear that out of anywhere. Other than the White House, everything, this is business as normal. Well, I don't think so, but okay. Well, the Hebrew verb used to describe the response to Babylon's mother country is bosh, ashamed. The theological word book of the Old Testament indicates that this verb is used in five distinct ways, two of which are germane to this context. The first way it is used to express that that sense of confusion, embarrassment, dismay, and disappointment when matters turn out contrary to one's expectations. We've all had that. We call that hope deferred. It makes the heart sick. And when you have an expectation of something and it doesn't come to pass and all of that, you have disappointment. You are ashamed in that sense. And the second way the verb is used is quite common and advances the idea to include the disgrace that comes as the result of defeat at the hands of an enemy. In 20, there can be little doubt that any favorable opinions that any people have toward the U.S. are quickly dissipating around the world. And that reliance on America has generally resulted in great disappointment. Those people who have relied on us, well, let's take a survey of all the people that we've helped and see how they feel about it. Let's ask the Shah of Iran how he felt about it. Let's ask Hussein. I mean, we propped him up and put him in power. And then, of course, when it doesn't suit our purposes, we'll tear him down and kill him. And so the reality is, of course, the Mujahideen over there that we armed and trained, and some of these people that are now part of the religious context over there that are fighting against us now. So we go about these things all backwards. And again, we propped up this historically. We've propped up the Soviet Union since World War II. And without infusions of American cash and technology and know-how and all of that, that nation probably would have collapsed. But we kept propped them up. And that's one of the things you see, and we're not going to do that passage, but you see this bear and it's propped up on one side. It's being held up by something. It doesn't say what it is in the prophecy, but it's being propped up by something. Well, we're the ones that have propped up the bear, and then the bear turns around and kills us. Well, that's divine justice for you. You get what you deserve for that. I'm going to live. I'm going to build my house right here outside the bear's den. It'll be fine. The bear will never attack me or kill me. Oh, I think they might. Well, 21, that disappointment, confusion, embarrassment, and dismay is not viewed as a fleeting or passing sensation. It is intensified by the addition of the adverb me'od, greatly or exceedingly. She will become exceedingly ashamed, greatly ashamed. Utter humiliation that because of her relationship with you. It bodes well for Britain, not for us. Well, 22, in another example of synonymous parallelism, the second statement repeats and amplifies the first. The verb kafir, humiliated, is most often used with the previous verb. Is used often with the previous verb and denotes the feeling of disappointment, failure, and dismay. that one experiences, that should be experiences, as a result of evil conduct or of God's judgment. And in this case, it is obvious that it is specifically the spiritually criminal conduct of the U.S. that has led to Yahweh's judgment. She who gave you birth, humiliation. It would be likely, point 24, likely be difficult to calculate the impact that the destruction of the United States, as well as her behavior leading up to the destruction, would have on the inhabitants of Great Britain. And again, you have to make, when you're dealing with nations, I understand that you have sort of the political attitudes that the nation may have through her leadership, and then you have the populace at large and their views on things, which theoretically, like other nations, are supposed to be represented by our politicians at some level. But we know that doesn't always the case. Well, there is no doubt that this would be intensified by several factors that include, A, the recent British exit from the EU means that the British have already become isolated from the political and economic forces that will govern the world under Antichrist. Now, there's still some discussion as to if all of this is still going to play out. I'm kind of the opinion it does, and I think the idea that them leaving the EU was critical in terms of prophecy, that they're not a part of that beast, the ten-headed beast we see in, or the beast with ten horns, rather, that we see in Daniel and then see again in Revelation, which are, again, the same beast. They're identical. So, one, Britain has already become slightly more isolated, and that, depending upon how the EU wants to play it, they can make things harder or easier on them. And what will they do? We don't know for certain yet. Well, B, another important factor is the nearly absolute dependence that Great Britain has on the U.S. to maintain its nuclear deterrent. That is a huge deal there. Because without us, their nuclear deterrent doesn't amount to much. See, in an article from 2014, Richard Norton Taylor indicates that without the cooperation of the U.S., says the report of the Independent All-Party Trident Commission, the life expectancy of the U.K.'s nuclear capability is in danger. If the U.S. were to withdraw their cooperation completely, the U.K. nuclear capability would probably have a life expectancy measured in months rather than years. Not only are Britain's Trident missiles in a common pool shared with the U.S. and maintained in Kings Bay, Georgia, its nuclear warheads are designed and maintained at the Atomic Weapons Establishment at Aldermaston with the help of U.S. know-how. And there, that's out of The Guardian, which is, you can check that out if you want to check that link. Read the whole story. There can be little doubt, point D, that Britain will be one of the many global merchants that are devastated by the loss of trade with Babylon. Since World War II, the U.S. has been Britain's main economic partner and source of investment and trade. And obviously, Pete was pointing out the other day too, another thing that Russia will probably like about this is that, if you're not familiar with it, that China has been steadily buying up U.S. debt. That they own a lot of us, as it were. And so when that all goes into default, you're not going to collect any of it. When that all goes into default, the Chinese are going to be scrambling too. And so when they watch this, obviously, they're going to, you know, it seems to me, I mean, we're told about this army that comes out of the east, and it's a 200 million man army. And frankly, China could field that by itself, but the leopard with the four heads would suggest there's a confederacy, that there are other nations involved besides China that probably share their ideology. Well, let's see, North Vietnam, North Korea, and you can pick whatever other one you want over there that'll likely fall into this because they are similar ideologically to the Chinese. So nevertheless, here, the prophecy in Daniel indicates that the United States is forcibly separated from Great Britain. That after they are forcibly, that nation will survive and will have a future during the millennium. Daniel chapter 7. And again, we're going to look at all of this, but Daniel 7 is still, I'm just stunned at the level of scholarship that is not displayed when they get to this chapter. And I mean the most technical, up-to-date commentaries just fall apart when they get to here. And almost all of them uniformly, I haven't found one yet, I don't think, that uniformly says Daniel 7 is nothing more than a recapitulation of Daniel 2 in different language. And that's their belief. And so they look at this and say the lion is Babylon, the bear is Medo-Persia, the leopard is Greece, and the beast, the revived Roman Empire. They do at least acknowledge that the revived Roman Empire has to come later in history. But first, Daniel 7, as we will point out, and for very good reasons, is not a recapitulation of Daniel 2 at all. That suggests that at the minimum that Daniel didn't understand what Daniel 2 was about. And Daniel is notorious, outside of Solomon, the most notoriously wise man of the Old Testament is Daniel. Your wisdom surpasses Daniel's, it says. So that means that Daniel's up there in terms of his understanding and all of this. So to say that Daniel didn't understand the information in chapter 2, well, number one, he gave the interpretation to the dream. I suspect he did understand it. And then say, well, then God gives him the same information all over again in a different form. Why? For one thing. And there are proofs, and we will show you what they are. There are proofs that Daniel 7 is not a recapitulation of Daniel 2 at all. And the vast majority of interpreters have missed this. And key in all of this is the reality that there's one little word in here that the whole thing hinges on. And it's one little preposition. And if you're not doing the work in the languages, you're going to miss it. I guarantee. And most who did work in the languages missed it. There was one pastor, I can't remember who he was, but he was informed about this and he was teaching. And he was informed that Daniel 7 is not the same as Daniel 2. And even when shown the proof, he said, well, that may be, but I'm not going to teach it. Well, that's intellectual honesty. You got to love that. Mm-hmm. Even if it's the truth, I won't teach it. Well, hallelujah. That's what we need you up there for. Well, maybe you should get out of the pulpit. That might be an idea. Well, Daniel chapter 7, verse 12. And as for the rest of the beasts. Now, in context, he's talking about this fourth beast primarily. But the beasts are enumerated for us in the four beasts back in chapter 7, verse 4. The first beast was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. Second beast was a bear. Third beast, in verse 6, like a leopard. And the fourth beast, dreadful, terrifying, exceedingly strong, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. And so while he's thinking about all of this, here in verse 12, the fourth beast, he says in verse 11, was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. But as for the rest of the beasts, this leopard, this bear, and this lion that's left, their dominion was taken away. In other words, they're not going to exercise a monarchy any longer. They're not going to have a political power over which they govern any section. If not their own country. They don't. Their dominion is taken away. Means they are superseded by a superior force. That force is Jesus Christ. Their dominion is taken away because his kingdom is going to have dominion over all the planet. The mountain of the Lord will become the greatest of the mountains, it says. And so their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed time. Now, how long that is, we don't know, but I presume it's throughout the millennium. That they go into the millennium. What's left of them, there's not, obviously not much left in the world. The world's in a big mess. But how much of this gets fixed up after it's all over and done with? I would presume a lot of it. But the Western Hemisphere doesn't appear to ever get fixed. It says the smoke of her burning ascends forever and ever. And nobody ever approaches it ever again. And so, until after the millennium, and the new heavens and the new earth, obviously, this has to be fixed by then. But the new earth obviously doesn't have any seas, as we're told. It's all land. It's just one big giant landmass. Truly Pangea. One earth, one landmass. As the earth was originally, and most Many scientists will acknowledge that the land mass that we find on the earth now that's visible at one time was a singular mass. And you can easily just look at it on the map, and you can take Africa and pretty much shove it over to the east, or to the west, rather, and you'll see it fits up pretty well right up against what we got. Because this was all, and the tectonic plate movement, continental drift, and other factors that came about as a result of the flood prompted all this. And that whatever land bridges existed, now it's pretty clear there was a land bridge between Russia and Alaska at one time. That's pretty evident. But there were other land bridges. And as tectonic plates moved and as continental drift began to occur, these land bridges were dissolved. And so how did you get people down there in Australia on an island, essentially? Well, all of this happened, and it says the earth was divided. The ground was divided up in the days of Peleg, a little obscure verse back there in Genesis, which talks about the conditions after the flood, things were changing. And obviously many things changed, not the least of which was the vapor canopy was extinguished and gotten rid of. And immediately solar and radiological radiation began to permeate the earth more, and the life expectancy dropped massively. It dropped 90%, 95% of the life expectancy was gone. So, and that continued again, even by the time of Moses, 1500, circa 1445 BC. He said the life expectancy of a human was 70 years. 80 if you're fortunate. If by reason of strength you can survive another 10. Now again, do not confuse life expectancy with a generation. Those are two different concepts. They're not the same thing. Generations are not what a human lifespan is. Right now, I mean, we've got three generations in our family living on the planet. And I'm only 60, whatever I am, 63, I think. 63. How old am I? I'll be sure and let you know when my birthday is. A bunch of you missed it last year. That won't be tolerated again. So these people, these nations have a future, though. You know, Israel, obviously. But Britain... even Russia, ironically, they're going to survive all this. We won't. Which again, great irony there. Well, 27, Jeremiah then uses the interjection, hine, look, pay attention, to direct the reader to the importance of the following assertions. In this case, it serves as an indication that the judgment on Babylon has been executed. There, behold. That's kind of the purpose. Look at this now. Your mother is greatly ashamed. She's already humiliated. And that obviously is going to continue again to intensify throughout the because of the destruction. But again, I think she's already humiliated now. I don't think we're that popular with people. And certainly not with the British. But again, I just to point out that these verbs are calperfects. They are not imperfects, even though the New American Standard translates them as imperfects. So 28, the next statement regarding the least of the nations is also slightly problematic. And one reason for this is that there is no discrete verb. And many translators simply supply the imperfect of the verb will be or will become hayah. However, Jeremiah, point 29, frequently uses the verb hayah to describe the judgment on Babylon and the reversal of her fortunes. So if that's what he's pointing to, one might naturally expect it to be here. Jeremiah chapter 50, our chapter here that we're in, verse 3. For a nation has come against her out of the north. And towards the end there, our verb we're looking for, there will become no inhabitant in it. He frequently talks about the change in Babylon and uses this verb because it means to change from one state to another. It's like the Greek genomai. The Greek aimi is the to be verb. We don't have a Hebrew aimi. We don't have a Hebrew to be verb. So the verb to become has to do double duty in that once you become something, you are that. So it can be used of being. But the first thing you have to look at is that it signifies a change. Also, verse 10 here. Chaldea will become plunder. Also, verse 23, he uses Hayah frequently in this to describe the change in status. So if he's trying to describe a change in status, why not use, I kind of would expect it here, actually. How Babylon, at the end of that verse, how Babylon has become an object of horror among the nations. Also, 37. So, Hayah is used frequently here, and I won't look up the rest of these. There's four more in chapter 51 where Hayah is used to describe the change. A sword against their horses and against their chariots, and against all the foreigners who are in the midst of her. And they will become women. Again, an insult. That men aren't supposed to act like women. They aren't supposed to be dainty and effeminate and delicate and all of that. Men are supposed to be manly and have certain qualities that set them apart as men. And again, it does. You don't have to be a macho idiot. That's not what we're talking about. But there are certain obvious physical characteristics, mental, emotional characteristics of strength, stability, and all of that. This is what men are supposed to be. Now, it doesn't mean that women are inferior or any of that. That's not what any of this is getting at. But it's designed to be insulting. And you still see this today. People will still insult. You throw like a girl. You run like a girl. And these are insults that, I remember this from grade school. No guy liked being referred to as a girl. And you shouldn't. And you can see these other ones here, 51, 26, 37, 41, 43, all through this chapter, these two chapters of about 100 verses or so. He uses Hayah frequently to denote the change. So based on that, it does not appear that this should be taken as a statement, but as a title. However, the use of the feminine noun, akarith, last or least, adds an additional interpretive issue. The noun is used temporally to denote the latter part of a time or even the end of it. For instance, Deuteronomy chapter 11, that particular noun is found in verse 12. Deuteronomy 11:12, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning even until the last of the year. And there you would translate this interpretively, the end of the year. For us, we would say, obviously, December. That would be the end of our year. Also, Job 42:12. And obviously, the book of Job here actually is probably written, it's written by Moses. So the timing of it, when you look at these books, the language in Job is going to be kind of similar to Moses' style that you find in the Pentateuch. Because, again, while he's writing about a different subject, he's still the author, and so you expect. So when we look at these books aren't wildly, Deuteronomy probably and Job, are not wildly separated in time in terms of their writing. Now, they are separated in time in that the book of Job, probably the events described there occurred probably back in the time of Isaac or even maybe Jacob. So this was well before Moses' time. But the book itself was written by Moses. 42:12 here. The Lord blessed the latter days of Job. This means the days at the end of his life. The days after this big test, more than the beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, all of this, 7 sons and 3 daughters and all of that. So he's restored. Ecclesiastes, also chapter 7, verse 8. The end of a matter, and here you could even translate it as conclusion. The conclusion of a matter is better than its inception, than its beginning. It's one thing to have a good idea. It's another thing to take it through to fruition. Obviously, there's a sense in which this is pretty plainly true. So the end there is used of the end in terms of time, as opposed to, say, the inception or beginning of something. It is used of future time and has the sense of what comes after a man, i.e. his future or his posterity. Psalm 37, verses 37 and 38. Mark, the blameless man. In other words, take note of him and behold the upright. For the man of peace will have a posterity. And literally what you have here is because at the last to a man of peace. And it comes to mean, you know, at the last of what's after him. And again, they've translated here by the term posterity. To note that. And then verse 38, but transgressors will be altogether destroyed. What comes after the wicked will be cut off, again, after them in terms of time. The posterity of the wicked will be cut off. Well, this might suggest that the nation arises in the future, or that it is found at the end of history. But that much is obviously true, since the prophetic word indicates that it will be destroyed during Daniel's 70th week. Again, for all of these preterist interpreters who say, well, the book of Revelation's all already happened. No, it hasn't. That again, you have a fundamental flaw in the hermeneutic being used to deal with that book by many, many people. And of course, the same ones, many of these preterists are also of the you can lose your salvation ilk, too. Their theology doesn't just fall apart with their preterism and their refusal to acknowledge the futurist view of Revelation as the correct one. And so the futurist view of Revelation says this hasn't occurred yet. This is not going to occur until Daniel's 70th week. And of course, for those who accept predispensation theology, predispensational rapture theology at any rate, pre-Daniel 70th week. And all the texts point to this. Number one, we're saved from that hour which is about to try the whole earth. And that hour is technical for the 7 years of Daniel 70th week. And Christ delivers us from the wrath to come. Now that verse is not designed to say we won't go through Daniel 70th week. But it is certainly supplemental to that fact. It certainly does not contradict that fact. That we don't go through any part of Daniel's 70th week. And there are people out there that advocate, well, the church, they advocate all kinds of weird stuff. Like a split rapture. If you're oriented, you'll go. But if you're not, as a believer, you get stuck here. Well, first, that doesn't... How does that square? Where do you get a verse that even suggests that? I mean, just any verse that would suggest that. Or that the church goes through part of Daniel's 70th week because it's under discipline. There's no doubt that the church is not in a good shape right now. We know that. The Laodicean prophecy indicates that at the end it won't be. It'll be rich, and it primarily describes what I believe to be Western Christianity, because that's the most notable expression of it generally around the world. Not to say there aren't Christians in other places. There are. But Western Christianity has become very complacent, very fixed on wealth and money and the details and jobs that supply all this. We can't take less money. We can't step back. That's your average Babylonian. As a believer, get that out of your head. Verse number one, just because you've attained a certain lifestyle doesn't mean God wants you to have it forever. He may. But this is where you have to hold all this with an open hand. Everything you got, you better write this above it. Destined to perish. Because it's gonna perish. All your, quote, perfectly personal little knickknacks and trinkets that mean so much to you. Burned. Incinerated. Ashes. That's all they're going to be. And but again, we're not going to be around for that. So again, Dan, we suggest that, number one, that I think the scriptures are very plain on this. The church is taken out. This also signifies, that, you know, this is another issue they have. That these preterists and these other interpreters don't deal with. And that is, what about the change of dispensation? You got 7 years of history left for Israel because of that prophecy in Daniel. 483 years of the prophetic 490 have been fulfilled. But there's seven missing. And that has to belong to the age of Israel. So if you take the church and leave it here, now you're crossing dispensational boundaries again. Who is God going to work through, the church or Israel in Daniel 70th week? Well, it's Israel. It's not the church, because the church isn't here. So there's plenty of proof for all of this if people are intellectually honest. Most of them aren't. If they will study it, most of them won't. If they will simply look at the documentation, it's there. But they don't want to acknowledge this. And of course, even among the ones who do acknowledge it, well, it's good to know today's the rapture's tomorrow. That's going to be good. Be happy to know that. I just wish I knew what time it was. And sadly, I don't have enough time to drink all my wine tomorrow. I guess if I'm not going to have to study, though, I guess I could get up and see how far I could get. I'm not going to. It's a joke. I won't. Well, D, this has led some translators and interpreters to interpret this to say that prophetic Babylon would be the last nation formed in human history. Well, however, any study of history will reveal there have been quite a few nations that gained or established their sovereignty after the founding of America. For instance, Canada did not become a dominion until July 1867. So we're clearly not the last of the nations formed. There's no doubt about that. There are other nations who have gained their sovereignty and established all that since then. And of course, as you know, I remember when I learned in school, you know, they made us learn. We had to learn all the states in America and the capitals. And of course, I don't guess you have to do that now. But when they had, you know, I remember in third grade, they had this deal and it was, you know, the little wooden puzzle thing. And you had to be able to put the U.S. back together. You know, you dump it out, then you have to be able to put the states back where they went. Well, we had one for Europe and all of that, too. Europe and over into the Balkans. Well, some of those countries don't even exist now. But new sovereignties have been established. New names have been given to them. I don't care what they are. Because it doesn't really materially affect me. But, so we're not the last of the nations in that sense. You can't interpret this that way. We're not even the last of the nations to come into existence. And clearly we have to be there at the end. Babylon does. So that's all straightforward, I think. Well, 31, based on the use of the opposite term, Reshith, the first, the beginning, or the best, which is used with the same noun, goy. Some understand this to mean the last, as in the least important. Numbers 24, 20. Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end, and that's the word Akarith, the one we've got that we're using, his end or the disposition, as we say here, shall be destruction. And then Amos 6:1, Amalek was the first of the nations, i.e. one of the most prominent. And most important, Amos 6:1, and he will become unimportant, is the idea. The last of them, as in the least important. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion, and to those who feel secure in the mountain of Samaria, the distinguished men of the foremost of nations, to whom the house of Israel comes. And then Reshith, that's the head, Akarith would sort of be the tail, you might say. If the head's the most important, the tail would be the least important. The tail end of the nations. Well, this title, Least of the Nations, is certainly a fitting one for the demotion of the U.S. from her lofty position of power. It stands in sharp contrast to the ways in which Babylon is described prior to her judgment. And Isaiah 13:19, we've seen Isaiah here, but quickly, I want to get through this today, so if we don't look all these up, deduct it from my pay, I guess. Of course, you could go home and look them up yourself. What? Study on my own time? I put in 5 hours a week here. Well, so do I, and I study on my own time. And Babylon, the beauty of the kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride. Well, that's obviously, in that sense, you would describe that as the head of the nations. The chief, the foremost, most notable, most important. Also, 47:5, Jeremiah 51:7. Actually, when you look at the Jeremiah one, we've seen Revelation also that the nation clearly is so important that when it goes down, the nations around it collapse and go into, you know, fits of convulsions of despair. Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. And that symbolizes, obviously, blessing. And a place of prominence that God has used. Again, don't get confused with various terminology, client nations and this and that. First, none of that in here. The Bible doesn't teach any of that stuff. It teaches that God deals with nations, but there's only one nation He's ever really dealt with to speak of in terms of covenants and promises and all that, and it's Israel. They are His nation. The rest of the nations out here are all on the same at the playing field's level in that sense. They're just other goyim nations, the Gentiles. And you can also see Revelation 18, 7 and 8. So verse 12 closes with three descriptions of the United States following her destruction, which the Septuagint combines into the single translation, desert. So the first term, Midbar, wilderness, emphasizes the lack of human inhabitants in a region rather than the precise type of landscape or climate, although these regions are generally hot and arid. The second term, Siyah, parched, emphasizes the matter of dryness or drought and the thirst that might accompany such conditions. The final term, Arava, desert, also seems to emphasize the matter of dryness and the barren nature of that terrain. So these three terms are often used in conjunction with one another, and may be synonyms in some contexts. The desolation of these places are fitting symbols for the result of God's judgment on Babylon, which is noted explicitly in verse 13, and that's the one we will get to. We're going to review, again, the first part of Daniel. I think there's only about 7 or 7.5 pages. We won't be in that long. I'm just going to cover it. But verse 13, because of the indignation of the Lord, she will not be inhabited. And everybody who passes by Babylon will be horrified, and they will all hiss because of her wounds. So people, again, they're not going to approach it. But however they get to get any visual from it, they're going to have to stay a long ways off. But again, how much of this will be able to be seen? I mean, unless this knocks all the satellites out of the earth or whatever we got. And of course, we don't know how all that's going to change. Because what we do know is that the rotation speed of the earth is going to increase by about a third. It's going to be spinning faster, like a top. And part of that comes from the mass being shrunk. How much mass is expelled, and then how much of the earth just collapses in on itself. And if you think all these earthquakes and all of this and fracking may have created big chasms, well, don't worry, they'll collapse. And the land will probably drop about 800 feet. You talk about a sinkhole. I mean, however much it is, it may be far more than that. Okay, well, our time is gone. We will stop there. I have your notes for Daniel 7. I sent those out yesterday. And we will just quickly review that before going on with this. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these matters. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our understanding and spiritual growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.